extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here!
Oh, from New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time. I'm Andrew Wiebe with my partner in soccer, Matt Doyle. Match day 13, insanity. 52 goals, the second most on a single day in MLS history, and the first of three. Rivalry week presented by Continental Tire Match Days for us to break down in the next, about a week or so. Messi mania in Montreal, but it's Laurent Courtois' team that makes the noise, then, of course, loses because Miami gonna Messi. Hell is Real deep dive coming up. Lucho, Kelsey, Noonan versus Nancy. Cincy Shield chances, and the crew clearly have a CONCACAF hangover. Plus, Cascadia, Seattle got a much-needed win against Portland, and Phil Neville and the Timbers are feeling the heat, and everybody is feeling the power in the air from Christian Benteke. His head is a national treasure. DC should hold on to it forever. Plus, alarm bells are ringing in Atlanta, and we had a Royal Rumble, Doyle, in the sixth between Toronto FC and New York City, followed by a he-said-he-said situation that's still ongoing between John Herdman and Nick Cushing, and that's like 40% of what happened in the match day. Doyle, what's up, man? How you doing? How you feeling? That Sunday night column must have killed you.
Yeah, that was an epic this week. And then starting this morning, Jill Sakovic and I, we did match previews for everything coming up on Wednesday and then a few coming up on Saturday as well, because maybe we're into it now. Like the season officially starts when we have our first double game week. And I see it in your eyes. You just realize you're going to be working until about 4 a.m. on Thursday morning.
And so I usually rest on Tuesday and Wednesday. My week, your week, all of us here working at MLS on the media side, our weeks are probably different than most. Normally my week is like very intense from Thursday through Monday. You know, Thursday I'm prepping, Friday I'm prepping, Saturday we do all the shows, watch all the games, Sunday instant replay, and then Monday here with you on Extra Time, you know, the real tone setter for all of that. And normally I just sleep straight up on Tuesday and Wednesday. I might play golf one time just to get outside the house and walk around a little bit, hang out with my kids. No sleep. 13 games on Wednesday night. Rivalry week presented by Continental Tire rolls on. And I was looking at the matches before we break down all of Saturday and Sunday, Doyle, for Wednesday. And I'm like, oh my God, this is low-key an amazing midweek slate. Yep. 7:30 alone. Orlando, Miami, DC Red Bulls, Atlantic Cup, Cincy, Atlanta. Atlanta under huge pressure. Montreal, Columbus. We get Nancy against Courtois again. And Philly, New York City. And then you just keep going. Minnesota LA Galaxy might be like a background match on rivalry week, but it's two of the best teams in the entire league. Even Portland San Jose at the end of the night is the desperation derby. Like, it's on, baby. And yeah. I'm going to be tired. I need to take a nap today. So let's make this semi quick. What's the best thing you saw from match day 13?
I think Lionel Messi trying to figure out the new MLS rules about being substituted. He took a little ding in the middle of the first half when I forgot who it was coming together with, but it looked like his foot got stepped on and he was down for a bit, and the training staff had to come on the field. And with the new rules, you have to come off the field for 2 minutes. It's almost like a sin bin in hockey, and Lionel Messi learning that in real time on the sideline and like clearly upset about it. And as that's happening, Matias Rojas steps up to the only free kick he will probably get this season because all of these go to Messi, and he absolutely scorches it into the upper 90. Just an incredible, very MLS-y sequence of events up in Montreal.
You think it was on the field, like, oh, okay, Leo's not here. What do we do? What do we do? Who has a left foot? Who has a left foot? Someone, any left footer, please step up to us. And you said scorches. This was,
yeah,
more
was
like
more,
a,
yeah, more
like a looping,
right?
Banana curler into the top corner that, you know, maybe in some world Sarawak would do better on. But like, is if Messi hits that free kick, that's all we're seeing.
Yeah.
Across the world on social media.
8 million views on social media.
No doubt.
Yeah. No, it was like he hit that one with the deep magic, the way it was moving, man. It was fantastic. And I still can't believe that Anders and I were sitting there in the green room while you were getting, you know, makeup applied to your ankles. And we were talking about how good Rojas has been. And like, two or three years ago in MLS, this would be the type of guy that a team would add, and it would be like one of the biggest signings of the season. He's an in his prime Paraguay international attacking midfielder coming from Corinthians, which is one of the biggest clubs in all of the Americas. And he's walked into this Miami lineup, and he's elevated what was already, I think, the most talented attacking group in the history of MLS. They're spoiled, an embarrassment of riches. And it gives them flexibility when the summer window opens to maybe make some moves, kind of shore up that defense, because good Lord, do they need to shore up that defense.
Imagine Inter Miami still with flexibility. What a job Chris Henderson has done, and ownership and everyone involved.
I feel like a lot of these guys must be taking the you get to play with Messi discount, right? Like a lot of these guys are like, okay, you know, I'll sign this deal and I'll probably make more on the deal coming off of this one, because I'm going to score goals for fun because I'm playing with the greatest playmaker in the history of the game.
I mean, I'm taking 25% less on Mondays to podcast with you. I never told you that, but I think you should know.
Nobody's believing that. Nobody in the world is believing that.
Hey, you know what? Patrick Agumon is doing his very best big dunk, Duncan McGuire impression. I'm not necessarily talking about the goals, Doyle, and this is my best thing. I'm talking about displacing DP forwards. You need a designated player forward? If you want a job, don't be on the same team as Duncan McGuire and Patrick Agumon. Agumon Hive, we up, baby, and we up big. Game-winning goal against Nashville, a 1-0 win, a really nice turn and finish. I mean, he absolutely tattooed this ball into the side netting. Three goals on the year now for Patrick Agumon. After he scored it, he got the crown up in the stands and was just buzzing, like biggest smile of all time. I love to see you happy, Pat. I want you to know that. And then afterwards, here's his quote, talking about what he and Kervin Vargas want to do. Quote, we want to light the league up. Light it up. The Hive loves it. And then Dean Smith says, we're really pleased to see Patrick doing well because he's got bags of potential. There's a lot of stuff to work with, but he wants to get better, and that's the beauty of it.
Are we going to go into that potential now, or do you want to save that for later on?
No, let's do it. Pat Agumon, off the top, match day 13, biggest story by far, go.
All right. Very obviously, he knows where the goal is. His underlying numbers are good. I think he's in about the 70th percentile in terms of non-penalty goals in just 800 minutes. So you have to take it with a grain of salt. That said, guys who score at a high rate in college and then in MLS Next Pro or USL Championship, which he's done, it has tended to translate up. His non-penalty expected goals per 90 is about the 60th percentile. So that could use some work, but bear in mind he's playing for a team that doesn't have a real true chance creator.
But they don't have designated players, Doyle.
Yeah, but I mean, I think technically Brecht de Jagere is a...
No.
Yeah, exactly.
No, he can be bought down, and he should be bought down, and it's just a accounting mechanism. I will not accept that as an actual designated player.
So this is a team that doesn't have a high-level chance creation engine, and Agumon, as a second-year pro, is still finding chances at an above-average rate and then scoring those at an above-average rate. That's the ground floor stuff that you want to see from a striker. But what separates him is when he gets on the ball, he can... I mean, this goal he scored this past weekend to give Charlotte the 1-0 win over Nashville, he leaves Jack Mayer for dead, right? Like, that is just the, you know, Anders and I, we were talking about, like, is he like a Brian White type? And Brian White is a little more polished at this point, which is what you would expect of someone who's been in the league for 7 years. But Brian White is never going to score that goal that Agumon scored this weekend, where he just buries a defender in space and then rips it to the back post. So what we're looking at now is a kid who has, I think, special gifts in terms of physicality and 1v1 ability, and then a growing comfort in doing like the baseline center forward stuff in terms of chance creation. And now with Enzo Capetti reportedly about to head out the door to Rosario Central, it's 2 months until the summer transfer window opens. And as you said, Charlotte have one DP. They have the flexibility to go out and add two DPs. I think Adjiman has 2 months to win this job to show that, no, you don't actually have to go out and spend a DP on the number nine position, because I'm that guy. I'm going to give you 15 goals and 5 assists this year. And it's up to, frankly, it's up to Dean Smith to get that out of him, right? This is part of the job for an MLS coach. The only MLS coach who gets to work with finished products is Tata Martino. Everyone else has work to do to try to improve the players that are on the roster. And just looking at how this kid has already produced and the gifts he has physically and both physically and technically and in terms of his sort of soccer IQ, I don't see why you would go out and spend a DP slot on this position. I think you give him the chance over the course of 2024 to show that he can do this job. And if he gets that chance, I'm betting he takes it.
It's the ability to separate.
Yeah.
I mean, when he gets a step or he takes a step or he gets an arm or a shoulder into defenders, there is just immediate separation. And for a forward in the box, outside the box, trying to create the opportunities to get in high leverage, high efficiency shooting positions, that ability to separate is everything. Are you just a little bit smarter? Do you understand where the space is going to be, where the first touch should go, where your run should be, where you should start that run? Those are all things it seems like Adjiman is learning and adding. But what gets you excited about young players is when you see that progress game to game, opportunity to opportunity, and you also don't see him broken mentally, because inevitably within the developmental curve, you're going to fail. You're going to have bad games. Adjiman has had bad games. He's had moments where he should have finished, where he cost his team results and points because he was in the position to make a game-changing play and didn't. But I've never once seen him lose belief, put his head down, any of that. And if he's just a little bit cleaner, like this goal, for example, Doyle, I don't think this is the cleanest of touches for him. I think there's a little bit of sort of, you know, let's say argy-bargy, just to go with the Dean Smith effect here. Just sort of like the ball hits his feet in the right way, but once he gets there, he's still calm. If Adjiman can take clean first touches, that clean touch away from defenders into space to run onto, nobody can keep up with him. Nobody. So if he's just that little bit cleaner, his developmental curve is going to keep going up, and he's already looking like an absolute beast. Congratulations to him. Great goal. Sorry to everyone who watched this game. It was a terrible game.
Terrible game, but I mean, hey, as long as Patrick Adjiman is smiling at the end of it, we're happy.
Yeah, I don't care. I don't care. Like, Charlotte fans will be happy. Nashville fans, that was extremely whack. We're getting it out of the way here, so we'd have to talk about it down the line. Here was the quote from Gary Smith. Quote, from where I'm sitting, it's a nil-nil game. Ugh, oh, God, that's just tough if you're watching that game with Nashville interest. I've just looked at the stats, compared the stats. Very tight game. Few chances either way. And, you know, unfortunately, fall on the wrong side of the game. They had 0.2 XG. They created nothing at all. I don't have anything else to say about it.
There was some hope in certain circles last week after that 4-1 over Montreal that they had sort of discovered something Nashville had, and certainly didn't look like it in this one. And look, it continues to be both a game model issue and a personnel issue. And the personnel issue right now is really grim. In central midfield, they just don't have anybody who can progress the ball. Drew Yearwood, I understand that signing. I think he's shown some good moments in MLS, but thinking he was going to be able to replace Dax McCarty was anyway.
Yeah, we'll move on. We'll move on. How about some rivalry fireworks? We're going to start in the state of Ohio, where it seems like MLS just lives these days. Columbus had never lost to Cincinnati at home. They hadn't won in 6 MLS matches. Meanwhile, Cincinnati coming in off 3 straight wins. And for about 70 minutes, it was, I don't know if even is the right word. I think Cincinnati were by far the better team on the day overall, Doyle, but it was scoreless. And then Kevin Kelsey comes on, changes the game. Now, it has to be said, Aiden Morris also came off. Kevin Kelsey scores off a beautiful assist from Lucho. Lucho does his thing as well. It's 2-0. Max Arfston gets a late goal for the Crew, but here comes Cincinnati. 4 straight wins, revenge for that Eastern Conference final loss at their home building. Just an efficient road performance. They didn't give Columbus anything in the first half. And then it's like, you know, it's classic Cincinnati, but it's not just attacking transition moments in this game, Doyle. They used the ball. They built. And a lot of that, I think, comes down to Kelsey's place on the field, but also Lucho being Lucho. There's a reason why you build around that man.
Yeah, I think the second goal is really a great example of what you're talking about, where they were building. Now, it starts with a long ball to Kelsey's chest, and his ability to control that and then start a possession sequence, that's something that, I mean, Cincinnati didn't have that in Brandon Vasquez's absence. They lost that. So that's part of it. And then you see how it unfolds from there with Kelsey making a good run into the pocket and then, you know, taking an extra touch to sort of collapse the defense and give Oriano the edge. And then at that point, when he backs centrally into, like, Kelsey backs into, like, sort of the middle of the pitch, he collects multiple center backs with him, which gives Lucho the seam. And this is really good soccer. This is really good intuitive soccer, and it has to be so invigorating for Cincinnati fans and that coaching staff to see it click that quickly between Lucho and Oriano and Kelsey, because up until this game, Cincinnati had been in the shield race because they have the best defense in the league and because Lucho is a match winner. Coming out of this game, I wrote it in my column, coming out of this game, this is the first time all year I felt like, oh, they're going to stay in the shield race because sometimes they're just going to outscore teams. Sometimes they're just going to go out there, and because the balance is right and the talent is so elite, they're just going to score three or four goals. And I didn't feel like that at any point this season, and it took 25 minutes at the end of the game in his second appearance for me to already feel like that about Cincinnati with Kelsey.
I mean, it makes sense. Sort of the slow start from an attacking perspective for Cincinnati. There were six starters on the field for the Eastern Conference Final that are not around anymore. The Columbus Crew did make it. Look, Nancy made some lineup changes in this game, and we can talk about them if we want. Matan at right wing back, and Yeboah didn't start. Zawadzki was out there. I mean, I don't know if that's we'll save that for the Crew part. But Pat Noonan has been in the process of building something. He had told me that they've done more video this year, both in preseason and up till now, than they've ever done before. Just trying to get people up to speed to understand exactly what they're asking in any given situation, whether it's with the ball or without the ball. And Noonan said afterwards, this is probably our best performance of the year. You could tell he had big time pride. It was the continuation of a theme. That theme is one goal wins for Cincinnati. All seven of their wins this season have come by a single goal. They have won, I think, 29 matches since the start of 2023. That's all comps. 22 of those have been by one goal. I mean, that's insane. He said last week he would like to have a little bit more comfort late in games. And good thing they had the comfort when Max Arfson scored. But they're mature, as you pointed out about the defense. They're elite at keeping you, one, out of their area. And two, if they let you in there, defending inside of the area, preventing good shots or blocking shots, which we saw in this game. And then three, Roman Celentano has been extremely good.
Yeah.
He's preventing basically half a goal a game on XG values just via his performance. It's coming along. And this was not a game where they didn't have to make changes. It wasn't like, hey, run out the 11 and we're just gonna go. Continuity, continuity, continuity. Alvis Powell got hurt. And they don't have right now, because of injuries, backup wingbacks. So guess who went and played wingback? Yuya Kubo went from striker back to right wing back and played for Alvis Powell. Dado Valenzuela, a 19-year-old, came in and had one of the best performances I've seen him play in MLS, maybe the absolute best. And yes, Kevin Kelsey played a wonderful game. Here's the word from Pat on Kelsey. I mean, obviously it's the profile they needed, everything, etc. But he compared him to Yersa Mascara when we were chatting last week, Doyle. Like, basically in the sense that he has all the tools in the world, but he's still a little bit raw. Mm-hmm. And so, again, to go back to video, they're using video as Kelsey arrived to get him set, and they're trying to hold the expectations back a little bit. Games like this are not going to help, but they're trying to hold those back a little bit and let him settle, because his fitness is not there yet, and he just arrived with the group. But man, clearly, even at 19, he has some serious tools. What are the odds they win the Shield again?
By the way, Jerson Mascara balling out for a very good Villarreal team in La Liga. I still think that Miami are significant favorites to win the Shield. If you gave me Miami versus the Field, I would take Miami. That said, because Cincinnati's floor is so high because of that defense and because Roman Salentano has been probably the best keeper in the league this year when he's been healthy, they have more than a puncher's chance. They're not going to go away. Miami's going to have to run away from them. Miami has the talent to do that, obviously, but it's not a foregone conclusion.
Let's talk about Lucha real quick, because the reason you can go entertain the Shield or MLS Cup or Leagues Cup or whatever it is that Cincinnati can and could accomplish is because of the number 10. 6-6 already this year in 1,000 minutes. He leads the league in key passes. He just makes plays, that the ones that matter the most, Doyle. And what is so impressive to me in the 18 and around the 18, but in particular this game inside the 18, is sort of his agility, his ability to change directions quickly, to move the ball with him, but then also to sort of mask what his intent is. And you see it on the first play when he comes in and it looks like this dude's crossing. Here's the chip. It's that little, like those little choppy steps, and then the fake chip, down goes the defender, and then a perfect lofted ball to Kelsey on the back post. And on the goal again, look at poor Patrick Schulte. Look at Marrera. I mean, Lucho cuts Marrera, who goes steaming past him. I'm not even sure it's bad defense. I think it's just great attacking. And then Schulte just has no chance to even move.
Yeah. It's gorgeous to watch. And you look at it, and you know it's coming, and you're like, I think everybody knows it's coming, and you can't stop it anyway. And it's something that we talked about as we were watching on Saturday night, and it's like, it's his deceleration. And it's the same principle that we see, you know, across sports, right? Like wide receivers and running backs in football, deceleration is what makes guys miss. And, you know, highest levels of basketball, guys like Luka or Jalen Brunson, like they get that little bit of separation, then they hit the brakes and guys fly right past. Lucho is one of the very best that we've ever seen in this league in that aspect. He can create space to shoot or pass by creating instant separation with his first step and then create even more space when he stops. It's awesome. And it is a type of soccer athleticism that I think goes underappreciated in certain circles, but it's certainly more decisive in our game than like raw top end speed. You got, like, if you want to be one of the best players in the world, you have to learn how to slow down on a dime. And if you can do that, then you could do stuff like win MVP and win Supporter Shield and get offers from PSG and be one of the great players, frankly, in MLS history. Like, Lucho is entering the upper echelon of number 10s that we've ever had in this league. And that's not something that I think was a given even 6 years ago when he and Wayne Rooney had that awesome half season for DC United. It wasn't a given it was going to be like this. Well, he came back to MLS and ended up with the right coach and the right team. And yeah, top echelon playmaker that we've ever had here.
The one thing I will say about Lucho in Cincinnati is it comes into clear focus how important it is to have players around him that understand he's the man and understand how to make the moments when he decides it's on more effective, whether it is with their movement, and that is runs in front of him, but also to get out of the way and give him the ball sometimes. Like, that was the issue with Bupenza, I think. When you took that space away from Lucho to be Lucho, it's just the team didn't function the same. And with whether it's Kubo or Baird or Kelsey up top, you can just see there's an understanding of like, hey, 1A is to let Lucho be Lucho, and 1B is I'll probably get the reward. And if not, I'll be celebrating with Lucho over in the corner. Like, Lucho's not a crazy efficient passer. He's a chance taker. And sometimes that hurts Cincinnati because he loses the ball in bad spots or rushes attacks when he doesn't need to. But you'll take all those moments when you can cover for them with that back line and these selfless attackers around him because of the two or three moments he can give you a game where the ball's in the back of the net and you walk off winning. What should they do in the summer, Doyle? I just mentioned Aaron Bupenza. We're not going to see him probably until the summer with that broken jaw. What's an ideal summer for Pat Noonan in Cincinnati?
I mean, ideally, Aaron Pupenza, makes his apologies to the team and comes back and has instant chemistry with Kelsey and Lucho and plays like the high-end talent that I think he is. This guy was 99th percentile in both non-penalty goals and non-penalty expected goals during his time on the field last year. He's a good player. He wasn't a good fit as a sort of lead the line target forward earlier this season. And we all know that off the field stuff is not strong suit. I still think that there is so much talent there that you give it a chance to work out. That said, wouldn't shock me at all if they were like, nope, we gave it a year and it's not the right cultural fit for us. And we're going to have to look at some sort of parting of the ways and bringing in another DP center forward. But that's what they're looking at, right? Like, that is, like, oh yeah, they need probably a little more depth at both wing back slots. And, you know, maybe if they can develop another central midfielder, that would be helpful as well. But like, the real question mark around this team determining their ceiling is Aaron Pupenza.
It's too bad that he already played in Saudi, because that would be a good place to send him. But we'll see what happens with this one right now. Four straight Potter's wins for money. Cincinnati. Yeah, that's true. Somebody's got money. No doubt about that. I want to take a mea culpa here in public. Just want to throw myself on the train tracks a little bit because, pregame show, BWP and I were asked, who would you take to win the Shield, Crew or Cincy? And we both said Crew. Who would you take to build your team around? We both said Cucho over Lucho. And that crow tastes real good on this Monday morning.
Why did you say the Crew
because I'm stupid.
Okay.
Because I'm stupid, I'm bad at math. That's what it comes
Anders,
down to.
Can we put that in the intro, please?
Columbus Crew. Let's get to them here. Hail End hit us up, and this is a Cincy fan trolling. Said, hey, I'd like you guys to break down how the Crew are going to lose the Pachuca, sit on the edge of the playoff line, and have wasted the first third of their season, as well as all their efforts in CONCACAF. But we are looking at a sort of on the knife edge moment here. Doyle, seven straight games without a win, I should say, hovering right above the playoff line in the East. Five straight away games to come in MLS: Montreal, Chicago, Orlando, New York City, Miami. And in the middle of that, they go to Pachuca for a one-game final in the CONCACAF Champions Cup. So I ask you this: will the Crew be more like the Sounders in 2022? You know, you hope they win it, but then they don't make the playoffs and just CONCACAF takes everything out of them when it comes to the regular season. Or will it be LAFC in 2023? You know, maybe they lose, maybe they win in the final, but they keep the level high, they make the playoffs, and they go to a bunch of other finals. Which is more likely to happen for this Crew team?
I think the second one. Right now it's looking like the worst of both worlds, right? Because it is a one-off at Pachuca. Columbus will not be favorites. Even though Pachuca did just lose this weekend,
they'll be rested and they'll have time to prepare. Yeah.
But like, a loss is the most likely outcome there. And then if you stack it on top of their seven winless and they're about to start a five game road trip, like, they could be down to the bottom of a hole by this time next month. I refuse to allow myself to worry about this team though. They've met every test so far. Wilfred Nancy has met every test as a manager so far. So even if they lose, and even if they only get, I don't know, 3 points out of this five-game road trip, I still think Columbus is going to end up being one of the best teams in the league by the end of the season. And yeah, like, it wouldn't shock me if they won League's Cup. It wouldn't shock me if they snuck into, you know, the playoffs as a seventh seed and then went back to MLS Cup and won that. Like, I think that's all on the table for Columbus, because the most important thing is that they know who they are. They have an ideology and a philosophy for how they want to play, and everyone on that roster is bought into it. And as long as that keeps being the case, I can't bring myself to worry about their regular season form right now. Okay, they're not going to win the Shield. All right, fine. I don't think anybody really, other than you and Brad, I don't think anybody really expected them to win the Shield.
Ugh. Wilfred had a quote after the game that I think was to this point. Quote, I had a weird feeling about this game. It was like we were trying to catch up to what we usually do. And they did seem a little bit rushed at times.
Credit to Cincinnati for that, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, that's part of playing a great team.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's part of playing a great playoff or a great team, I should say. But yeah, they were a little bit out of sync. And I think one of the things you continue to see throughout this year is that teams have gotten really physical with them, especially as they're trying to build and create those overloads. And they're seeing those two central midfielders in Morris and Nagby get fouled a lot in positions, just kind of slow the game down. Because so much of what the Crew want to do is build that rhythm and move you around and find the just the right point to get out of the pressure and then to break forward. And right now, I think some of their rhythm has been disrupted. Just 6 goals in their last 7 games in MLS. How about Cascadia? Portland losers at home. Score the first goal, Felipe Mora, and then Seattle come back with 2 goals. Christian Roldan gets a big one. There was some question mark about offside. You can check instant replay for the update on that one. Then Raul Ruiz Diaz does what he does against the Timbers, and he hits a banger from outside the box. A huge win for the Sounders in a huge week for them. They're at RSL midweek, and then they're going to play at home against Vancouver at the weekend. They're now just 3 points out of a playoff spot in the West. Things are not as dire as they once were. Is it that dire for the Timbers, though, Joel? 3 points in 9 games. It's a loss sandwich with a draw filling. 3 losses, 3 draws, 3 losses.
Yeah, I think the Timbers are what their record says they are. The big issue is just defensively. They don't stop anybody or anything. And you kind of saw it on the Roldan goal where they're just able to build up the gut so incredibly easily. And then, it's not a high percentage shot, but it is a pretty open look from 26, 27 yards. That's not something you want to be giving up. And if you give up enough of those types of looks, you're probably going to have a bad break or two that can change a lead to a draw or a draw to a loss. I can't figure out the structure defensively through midfield. Now, part of that is because I don't think any of their attackers defends at all. So it's really easy to build against them. It reminds me of Austin a few years back in their first season, where anytime Aruti wasn't out there, they had 4 attackers who weren't doing any defending. And so teams just get comfortable playing against you. And I think that is what we've seen from Portland. They hit, 7 points from their first 3 games and winless in 9 since then. And the winless in 9, everybody that plays against them is able to get comfortable playing against them. So that puts the onus on the attack to outscore them, to outscore whoever they're just caution to the wind. And then, Juan David Mosquera pushes up from right back and leaves a door open on the counterattack. And Diego Chara is still, I think, a very good defensive midfielder in this league, but he's not superhuman like he used to be. And it's just a cascade of issues that have spun this sort of very sad web for Portland.
Pre-game quote from Phil Neville: "This is one of the most important games of the season for us." Post-game quote: "After a 2-1 loss at home, the first time I think 6 games the Timbers had lost to the Sounders, quote, the buck stops with me. That's 9 straight games without a win. Things are bad. They're last in the Western Conference. They're 28th in the Shield standings, and clearly that form, 9 straight without a win, 6 losses in that time, doesn't suggest better things are coming. Now, San Jose is coming midweek. And if you lose to, all caps, the Quakes, as you put it on Twitter, after a win for the Quakes against the Rapids, that's going to make the pressure that much more palpable. All right. Extra Time's Man of the Match Day. Congratulations go to Christian Benteke. DC United go to Atlanta, win 3-2. Benteke gets all 3 goals, all of them with his head. He now has 7 goals with his head on the season. We had someone hit us up, Matt Johnson, saying, can there be a Golden Head Award in addition to the Golden Boot? I mean, Benteke would win, obviously, but a hat trick of headers? Has that ever happened in MLS? I don't know if it has. I'm assuming it has. But I would call it the Golden Dome, I think. A Golden Head just doesn't, Golden Dome has a little bit better ring to it. Benteke is inevitable, Doyle. He's like Thanos. Everybody knows. Gonzalo Pineda knew. Abrams and Cobb knew on the back line. Every midfielder or outside back around them knew that second balls were going to be everything because Benteke is going to win every aerial ball played into him, and yet Atlanta still could not deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is going up against third and fourth string center backs, right? Like there are injuries in that Atlanta back line that made them, I think, uniquely vulnerable to this type of performance from Benteke. But part of it is just DC United have been really good under Troy Lesane at exploiting their advantages, and their biggest advantage as a team right now is the presence of the big men up top. And you could see it obviously on the goals, but also, as you said, on the second balls. The second goal was the one where Muyumba pushes way up because Atlanta have possession, and Atlanta want to be a team that has 60% possession and then wins the ball back quickly and knocks it around some more, like peak NYCFC were under Ronnie Dyla, that type of team. Muyumba goes to press, but there's not a clear pressing trigger. So that's one of your central midfielders who's rotated out of central midfield. And that leaves a very obvious escape ball for DC United, who are now being, you know, sort of disorganized. They're being pressed a little bit. It's disorganized, but you're still being pressed. You don't have all the time in the world. The escape ball is straight to Christian Benteke. And he has an 18-year-old on his back. He's fine. He's going to win that 100 times out of 100.
I mean, it doesn't matter, Doyle, who's on his back.
That's fair. That's fair. Like, yeah. Well, we might see, you know, because they're playing the Red Bulls, right? And Red Bulls have two of the biggest and you know, most physical center backs in the league. So maybe it'll matter in this coming game. But in this one, it certainly didn't. And he was able to direct it right into Matthias Klick's path. And then from there, it's just DC have this pattern of play where they get numbers up on the right and Benteke feasts usually at the back post. And that's how it played out. And it does not speak well of Atlanta that they didn't seem to know that was coming.
You said in your column, I'm loading up on DC stock. And then Ted Meyer hit us up and said, Troy Lesane for coach of the year, guys. Go look at the players listed as TAM and their minutes thus far. Yes, he has Benteke, but Rooney wasn't able to unlock Benteke nearly as much as Lesane has been able to. And I do want to read to you, sort of on the talent front, the TAM signings for DC and how they're doing so far. Steve Birnbaum has been hurt, hasn't really played. Russell Knauss, same thing. Christian Dahomey has been more of a rotational piece. Aaron Herrera, good player. Really good signing for them, even though I forgot about where he played on the last show. Mahadan Jeza, I can't even remember how to say his name. He hasn't been around for so long. Martin Rodriguez, same thing. It's pretty incredible what Lesane's doing. Outside of Benteke, where's the stock? Why is the stock going to rise, in your opinion?
I think, again, because this is a team that has a philosophy and they know who they are. And I also think, look, the sort of energy drink soccer that Troy Lesane coaches his team to play, it's proved to be a durable game model in MLS. Teams that play this style have had a lot of success. Now, none have won MLS Cup, and I don't think I would pick DC United to win MLS Cup. But these are teams that make the playoffs basically every year. And I do like the fact that within the blueprint that Lesane brought with him from the Red Bulls, they are actually keeping the ball on the ground a little bit more. They're connecting more passes per possession. So it's not all like last year, they like in New York with the Red Bulls, he pushed that approach to its logical extent. Like they were down in like 55% pass completion for like huge swaths of the seasons. We're not seeing that with DC. They're actually taking better care of the ball. So I like a lot about how they're playing. I think it fits the talent. The talent appears to be bought in. If there's something to be less bullish on, it's like, are their center backs good enough? I'm not sure they are. That's one. And then two is like, okay, they're doing these fun rotations with Aaron Herrera getting forward and Jared Stroud playing as sort of a central winger and Click getting involved. She's not a real high-end chance creator there. And that's where it goes back to the press. Well, the press is the best playmaker, and like that's probably true for this group. But I'm always more comfortable with a team that has a real alpha playmaker.
Oh, you mean like maybe a Thiago Almada? for instance. Wait, did that make you more comfortable? That's three straight home losses now for Atlanta. That's never happened before. Gonzalo Pineda said, was asked, how does this feel? Quote, very bad. This feels very bad, honestly. Yakumaki said, quote, today was just embarrassing. Right now, we're mentally really low. Our confidence is nowhere near where we want it to be.
Yeah.
How much pressure is Gonzalo Pineda under? They're below the playoff line.
Yeah. I imagine his seat is warm at this point. And, you know, Garth Lagerway, it's got to be Garth Lagerway who's making the decisions on this, even though Carlos Bocanegra is still there and ostensibly the GM. But Garth Lagerway has never fired or hired a head coach. You know, he inherited.
What an accomplishment, by the way, like in a roundabout way, like not in like, oh, congratulations, just how in the hell did that happen?
It's a lot of patience, right? He inherited Jason Kreis. He inherited Ziggy Schmidt. And then when Ziggy Schmidt I think it was Adrian Hanauer who made the decision to let Ziggy go. It was given to Brian Schmetzer, who then obviously did so well that he was going to keep that job forever. And then when Garth left Seattle for Atlanta, he just kept Gonzalo Pineda on. So we're entering kind of like uncharted territory here. It very clearly has to get better soon, because career-wise, 102 matches for Gonzalo Pineda, 1.33 points per match with what has been the most expensive or one of the most expensive rosters in the league.
Here's some context from The Athletic. They do a great job with their roundup on Monday mornings. I believe this was Jeff Reuter that had this. For the first time since 2018, no MLS coach has changed its manager within the first 11 games. We had 8 changes in 2023, a whole boatload. That may also be part of why we're not seeing as many changes now, because you have coaches early on in their tenure with clubs. I mean, Phil Neville and Caleb Porter would be two obvious ones for you. But we're sort of reaching that moment in the season where when moves happen, they tend to happen after you've seen, 11 to 15 games, let's say. And there's a pretty clear indication of what that team is and what it can accomplish. And right now, Atlanta are far from what they would like to accomplish. All right, other headlines. Let's go to Montreal. We've saved the Messi talk all the way until like 45 minutes in, which is a miracle. Also, semi-miracle that Montreal kept Messi pretty quiet in this game. Actually, they kept Miami quiet overall, just 7 shots for Miami. That's the lowest of the year. Montreal won the possession battle. They doubled up Miami in passes in the opponent's half. They had a 2-0 lead, Doyle. We were jumping up and down in the green room like Laurent Courtois ball it's here. First of all, a direct goal just straight down the field for Bryce Duke. Miami are going to be aggressive. They're going to get numbers high, and they're going to leave space in behind, and Montreal are set up to exploit that space. So the first goal was nice, but it was the second goal for Jules Andre Villasanta was just absolutely a perfect counterattacking, go direct, drop one of those two attackers in, get wide, get vertical, runners into the box. Miami can't cope with it. When they're running backwards, they're absolutely vulnerable. But then the inevitable, right, Doyle? It's like you can play better. You can be the better team for 95% of the time against Inter Miami, and it may not matter. They need like 3 minutes to score 3 goals.
Yeah,
and that's it. It's just like when they get a chance, they're more efficient than you. They're more talented than you. They have more guile. And that's it. You lose the game and you feel good at the end about the performance, but Miami are doing what they do, which is marching on to perhaps a supporter's shield and celebrating a win on your field.
There was a joke Anders made last week about how when there's a team like this, like Miami, the joke is always, oh, well, what will they do when they come up against a less because they're a super club, what will they do when they come up against a team that has the power of friendship? because it's one of the narratives. We're like, oh yeah, this collective, this group of players who nobody really thinks is that great can beat the super team because they work for each other. And the thing about Miami is they're the super team, but they also have the power of friendship. You know, like Suarez and Messi are best buds, as is Busquets, as is Jordi Alba, and they all seem to really enjoy taking the young players on the team under their wing. And I hate to reduce it to you know, oh, the collective mentality, but like, it's very clearly a thing. It's very clearly a thing. And when you have that kind of talent and that kind of buy-in together, and you know, Luis Suarez sneaking in at the back post opportunistically on a a corner kick.
And before that, by the way, I mean, there's a difference between that team, which makes mistakes but isn't naive and takes advantage of the moments they get, and Montreal, who had brilliant segments of play, especially in the first half, but makes critical mistakes, and not many, by the way, but Miami's always there to punish them. That goal you're talking about with Suarez, Bryce Duke flicks this on at the near post for Suarez at the back post. If you're Laurent Courtois, if you're Bryce Duke, if you're watching the film from a Montreal slant at all, you're yelling, this has to be anywhere but flicked back into the danger area. Any doesn't matter where this goes. Doesn't matter. Just not there. So that's a naive moment. You have to be better defending the near post. And then on the game-winning goal, this is Miami all the way back in their own 18. And then you don't get pressure to the ball. It gets played through you. And you're not aware of Benjamin Kromoski sitting on the line. Ariel Lassiter just doesn't, he's just not aware in this moment. And when you can't get pressure on the ball and you've got a free runner, the opponent's going to score. But those are the little details you have to get right against Miami. And you can get right 9 out of 10 times, but you better expect that 10th time they're going to score.
Yeah.
Yeah. Congratulations to Montreal, though, for everything but the win. I know it's 1 win in 8 games. They've hit a little bit of a slide. But you saw in this match all the things that we think Courtois can do to make a team special that doesn't have DPs.
Yeah.
We already did that rant, so we'll save it for a different day. But Miami with another win. How about another 3-2 away win? Orlando City going into Philadelphia. Philadelphia have lost 3 straight at home.
Philly have been, I think, maybe the most disappointing team in the league to me, because I wanted them to bring this group back, and they did. They brought back 98% of the minutes from last year's team, which was like 98% of the minutes from the 2022 team. And this is the group of players who made it to the semifinals of 2021 CONCACAF Champions League. You know, largely the same group of players. Largely the same group of players that, you know, missed out on 2022 Supporter Shield by the first tiebreaker and, you know, lost 2022 MLS Cup in like the second greatest game of soccer ever played. The team that made it one came in third in Leagues Cup last year. This is a team that year after year after year has come so close in so many competitions and never gotten over the hump. And I wanted them to keep this group together one last. And remember, it was an issue, right? There was no guarantee that Kai Wagner, Alejandro Bedoya, that those guys were going to be back, and they brought them all back, and they look like a different team. They're soft and sloppy. They're not engaged. We saw, I forget which goal it was, but Wagner plays Orlando onside and like doesn't run to get back. He just sort of holds his hand up. Jose Martinez, 2 more awful giveaways in this one. He's a shadow of his former self. And so, and they're just giving games away in a manner that is so uncharacteristic of what this group of players have been really over the past 4 years, because that's how long of them have been there, and some longer. And credit to Orlando for taking advantage of it. Now, part of this was like Philly missing chances. Like, they generated, I think, almost 5 expected goals. Our buddy Elliot McKinley from American Soccer Analysis, he put out that this was, Philly generated the highest expected goals total for a single game for a losing team going back at least to 2013. So it was a black swan kind of loss in that sense, but it's also very emblematic of the team that Philadelphia have become this year.
Daniel Gosdag missed a penalty that could have made this a 3-3 match. That's his first ever miss. Non-converted penalty kick in MLS play. I think he was 22 of 22 before that. Now, on the Orlando side, it was a little bit unconventional, let's say, shape-wise. So 3-5-2, and was I mistaken? Was it Torres and Angulo playing wingback? Ojeda in the team, as well as Ladero, just a single sort of dedicated defensive presence in midfield, and Araujo, and then Muriel and Duncan Maguire up top. And wouldn't you know it, despite getting bludgeoned in XG, Big Dunk gets a goal. Muriel gets two goals to finally get off the schneid, Doyle. And maybe the moment of this match from a personal standpoint for me was after Muriel scores the first and he's surrounded and the Orlando teammates are celebrating with him, and you can just feel that they all felt how much pressure had been mounting on Luis Muriel. And then Tom Bogert's reporting now that old Big Dunk here might get a contract extension. Talks have been reopened, but also Blackburn are flying across the pond because they really crapped the bed and now they got to try to fix it. How stupid would you feel? I know they fired the administrator or whatever, but if you're Blackburn, I think they stayed up in the championship, but like just barely. But my God, you dropped the ball, guys. Price just went up.
Oh, yeah. The price had to have gone up by at least 50% because like the one knock you could have said on Duncan McGuire was like, well, he overperformed his underlying numbers last year. There should be some regression expected, and there's been no regression. He's been pretty easily Orlando City's best player this year. He has done it both in league play and continental play. Yeah, if somebody wants to look, if they're negotiating a new contract for him right now, it's because they think they can get more money for him in the summer window. And this is okay, be patient. We're going to take care of you because you've been taking care of us. And we're going to make sure that you end up with the right team and not just, whichever championship club offers us the most money. And I'm still hoping for Club Bruges, by the way. Fingers crossed.
Yeah, seems like some mutual concern there. There is no mutual concern right now between Toronto and New York City, nor John Herdman or Nick Cushing. Like, it's a 3-2 loss at home for Toronto FC. New York City have won 4 out of 5. They're rolling after all the pressure mounted on Cushing. Insigne came back in this game. He looked pretty good, and that's a good sign for Toronto FC. Bernadeschi got a red card late on, and he won't be available midweek against Nashville. But it's the brawl afterwards, Doyle, that has everybody talking, most of all the two managers. John Herdman made some accusations about Cushing from the first meeting between the teams at Yankee Stadium, basically saying that Cushing cornered a 19-year-old member of the TFC squad. There were no cameras to capture it, et cetera. We were very frustrated about that. And then Nick Cushing has said afterwards, well, this is completely untrue. I have never done that. We're bringing in legal means on this. You can read all the quotes, both on Twitter, but also Tom Bogert in The Athletic has them rounded up pretty well. All that can be settled for a different day. But clearly something happened after the whistle that the disciplinary committee is going to get involved in. I mean, John Herdman is running and bumping Cushing. Prince Owusu and Sean Johnson are infuriated by something that happened on the field and chasing down New York City players. I mean, it's more than a coming together. It's like a baseball brawl, you know, where everybody gets on the field and they all get in sort of a pack and you can't separate it. And it's just like this amoeba that's just moving around the field. And in Toronto's case, it always ends up going toward the tunnel. What can we say about this?
I'm not saying anything about this. I'll talk about the game. I'll say that it's interesting that NYCFC have kind of leaned into becoming more of a counterattacking team. I thought that was especially evident in this one. It's not the City Football Group way. It is a departure from what they were under every previous manager before Nick Cushing, but it's working. You know, they are constantly dangerous. And I think part of this is like Santi Rodriguez is an attacker. He's not an orchestrator. And if he is the number 10, you want to play to his strengths. And his strength is in the open field, not doing the Maxi Morales stuff where he's sort of rearranging the chess pieces on the board. So it's been an evolution for NYCFC. I'm still not convinced it's entirely real because they have to defend a little bit deeper. And if you're going to defend deep like that, you have to be dominant in your own defensive third, really in your own box. And I don't see them as a dominant team like that. So I'm taking kind of a wait and see. As for Toronto, they've been kind of fun as a tactical experiment, pushing those fullback or those wingbacks really high. When Insigne comes back, he came back in, he's picking up the ball in sort of distinct or unusual spots, not really as a 10, not really as a winger, not really as a second forward. they strike me as a tough team to prep for. So I do think that they're going to face a lot of teams that do what NYCFC do, which say, all right, you guys, you're going to have to carry the game. And we're going to, rather than try to match you tactically, we're going to trade all of that for space to counterattack into. And I think that's going to be the problem that John Herdman has to solve for over the course of this season.
I do want to give shout out to one player in particular on New York City, Matt Friis. I think he's been very good this year.
Really good, yeah.
I mean, just watching the game, seeing the moments he stepped up and the underlying numbers, both say that he's been a very good keeper for them. Would be one of those guys that I know they moved him because there wasn't space in Philly with Andre Blake, but that was to New York City's benefit, no doubt about it. All right, let's make quick work of some of these games and try to get this done in under like 20, 25 minutes here. LA Galaxy 2, Salt Lake 2, one of the big games of the night. Looks like Salt Lake was going to have a big road win, 2-1, until at the very, very end, Miguel Berry got on the end of a cross from Ricky Pooge. You could say this was a Zach McMath howler. It might have been. I'm not a goalkeeper, so I couldn't tell you, but it looked like he hesitated a little bit there. But that's disappointing for the Salt Lake side. And the Galaxy were disappointed already because they felt they had the chances to win this game. Joe Pantel had his first big blip, I would say, about three chances that went wanting that he probably would have wanted to finish at least one of them. Any quick thoughts on the game? And then let's talk Emeka Nnelli.
Two very good teams that are both currently missing something that could make them great. And I think for RSL, it's very clearly like a high-level number 10. And I expect that to be a place they go shopping.
Let me ask you this. If you were RSL and you could make some signings in the summer, and they've had the money, they've made those signings over the last three windows or so, and you could choose either to have a high-level 10 or a high-level 9, what would you choose? Because I'm looking at their roster, and they have Barajas, they have Luna, and they have Crooks, and all those guys really can only play underneath the 9. I know Chicho can play the 9, but he likes to drop off the back line and has been super effective and productive, both with assists and goals, playing a little bit underneath. Would you invest in 10, even though you've already invested there, or would you do it at 9 and let Chicho drop back a little bit and be free?
I think Crooks is a squad player. I think Luna, they like him more as a sort of a playmaking left wing, and I think that Barajas is kind of similar in that regard. He might develop into a number 10, so might Luna, but that's not where either guy is at their strongest right now. I wouldn't touch Chicho's role. I would find a number 10 who fits with Chicho. And to me, the type would be a Driussi type. Because Chicho
can make runs beyond him too.
Yeah. Yep. And can use Chicho's movement to create new scoring chances, but isn't going to sort of overlap with the type of stuff that Chicho has done that's made him arguably the second best player in the league this year.
I'm just trying to decide what the sirens mean. Just in a, you know, omens and such on extra time. Just trying to figure that part out. I think the sirens mean it's time to talk Emeka Nnelli. You tweeted, I need the story of how Columbus let Emeka Nnelli sneak out of their academy. This kid is a freaking baller. Completely agree. I've been talking to Pablo Mascherani about him for weeks now because I've been so impressed. So I'm just going to give you, Doyle, a fellow Emeka Nnelli enthusiast, the rundown of what Pablo has said to me. And by the way, every time we talk about him, Pablo is literally like breaking his cheeks smiling. Like he cannot stop smiling when talking about Emeka Nnelli. Apparently, even Papa Mascherani, Pablo's father, called Anelli's elevation earlier and always holds it over Pablo. So, number one, Pablo says Emeka is one of the most amazing learners he's ever been around while coaching. Basically, they give him an opportunity to see something that we want to change on video. They do it on the field, and then Anelli executes it. Like you don't go back to him and have to figure it out. And he's a Cornell kid, so you can assume that he's been a good learner for most of his life. The initial plan with Nnelli this preseason, Doyle, and remember this well, he was supposed to be a right back. Mm-hmm. Like he was going to compete to be a starter there, and then he might be cover in midfield because Palacio they spent money on, and obviously Pablo Ruiz was the big star there. But things change fast. Palacio was with the U23s in preseason. Pablo Ruiz was recovering. So it was Ojeda and Emeka in preseason, and it was like, this is it. They didn't play one game together when Nnelli played it right back, and Pablo said the game model wasn't expressed right, and they went right back to it, and they haven't stopped. All his teammates, the big ones, Chicho, Vera, all the big dogs, love him. He can contain anybody, including Andres Gomez, 1v1. Pablo says he's a foundational piece. Doyle, he even mentioned in a couple years watching Anelli play for the U.S.
I mean, I wouldn't be shocked if he's part of the January camp at the end of the season. Certainly if he keeps playing like this and he keeps progressing. Because remember, he's still learning the position, right?
He was 100%.
He was not a central midfielder in college. He was an attacker. So his ability to get out there and perform at a high level but constantly be improving as he hits his mid-20s, it's really impressive. The thing I like most about him is how he shapes his body when he receives the ball. He's doing the thing that high-level central midfielders do in terms of disguising how he's going to receive the ball so that he can better maintain control under immediate pressure. And there are so many central midfielders in the world who never master that skill, and that puts a hard cap on how you can climb as a player. Anelli's ability to do that changes the way RSL can play with the ball. And it's as big a change as, say, Pablo Ruiz's ability to hit an accurate switch in stride. Like, it's that, to use Pablo's term, it's that much of a foundational piece. And Ojeda has it as well. And these two guys together in central midfield, there are times you're watching RSL play and whoever's on the ball runs out of ideas and they just cycle at the central midfield. And these guys are able to keep the ball until they get fouled. And both of them are at or near the top of the league among central midfielders in foul suffered. It's Nagby-esque in how they use that ability on the ball. And that means that RSL are not getting scattered. They're not getting frazzled in those tough moments. And over the past 5 years, that has been the Achilles heel of this team. Like, they haven't been able to hit the gas without losing all control of what's happening on the game. And it feels like because of Anelli, they have a much better ability to do that. They're not Columbus yet, right? And I'm probably never going to be, the Wilfred Nancy type of game model. But it's going in that direction, and it's given them, it's made them a much more difficult team to play against.
But they did have on the second goal 26 straight passes. Every player touched the ball, and then they scored. So there are moments where they show you that. There are moments where, I think to Anelli and Ojeda's credit as well, their ability to counter-press is really good because of the structure that they have. And when they lose the ball in the opponent's half, those guys step up into the proper zones, and Chicho's just a back-pressing beast that they win balls and recycle and go back to goal over and over because of it. Now, they're going to have regrets about the last goal, but another big week for them. They welcome Seattle midweek. All right, Colorado 2, San Jose 3. You got a lot of away 3-2 wins. Who would you take in this one? Who do you want to talk about?
We got to talk about Hernan Lopez, right? Like, the new DP number 10 comes in. I thought he was excellent in the second half last week, getting on the ball all over the attacking half, but especially in zone 14. Comes into this one, plays a significant role in, I think it was the first goal for the Quakes, and then volleys home the second one. It's good soccer in the attack that San Jose are playing now. And part of it is just having that focal point in number 10. But part of it is also by moving Nico Sakaris into more of an orchestrator role, they're able to get the fullbacks forward more effectively. I mean, we actually saw that on the Christian Espinoza goal. And that's a pattern of play with the left central midfielder sort of dropping out of the shape while at the same time the left fullback pushes up. Like, that's a Greg Berhalter pattern of play. Like, that is the literal pattern of play that we saw in the Nations League final, except with Gio Reyna dropping out of the midfield shape to hit that pass that people were furious about, but that Mexico had zero answer for. It's nice to see it come off like that for a Quakes team that I thought were not good attack wise last year, and who had been doing some good stuff earlier this season, that they lacked the high level pieces to finish off. Well, now, because of Lopez and because of Chakiris's ability to hit these difference making sort of field tilting passes, they're able to push Christian Espinoza higher and take some of the focus off of him. And we know when the focus is off of him, he becomes one of the very best wingers. So it's all sort of clicking for this Quakes team, whereas 3 weeks ago we felt like they were just dead in the water. And it just, very MLS, man, can change overnight.
Two straight wins, beat down LAFC, who beat down Vancouver this weekend, and then go to Colorado and win. Rapids got to be a little disappointed. They had, I think, 3 goals called back in the first half, in my opinion, all of them rightly so. 2 by Hafa Navahu that were clearly offside. And then the third is the one that they're a little frustrated about. Omer Fernandez scores, but earlier in the buildup, Kevin Cabral called for offside for blocking a Quakes defender. And I explained the whole thing in instant replay. We don't have time to do that here. But if you're the Rapids, you got to be happy about those Navajo goals. We'll see what happens in the summer with him. LAFC 3, Vancouver nothing. Vancouver got annihilated. Doyle, yeah. Just absolutely pounded, created almost nothing. Christian Oliveira got a couple goals in this game, and he was given those goals basically by Denny Bawanga, who found all the space and the time in the world on that left flank. And I knew that that's where LAFC were going to attack Vancouver. Vancouver liked to defend in a 3-4-3 shape, and there's a lot of space behind that right midfielder or right wing back, or if they're in attack, sometimes right winger. And that's where Denny Bawanga lives. And LAFC just found a way consistently to get him in space, running downhill toward the box. And when that happens, LAFC are going to run you off the field, because Denny Bawanga is basically unplayable in those situations. This is one that I think Vinny Sartini is going to have to go to the drawing board and be like, oh, okay, that wasn't it. What can we do differently?
You know, we saw it last year in the playoffs. Vancouver had been playing a 3-1-4-2 with Andres Kubas as the lone defensive midfielder, single pivot, and he was asked to cover too much ground against LAFC in the first leg of the playoffs, specifically for the reasons you just delineated with regards to Bawanga's ability to get behind the right wing back and get into space. So Vanny switched to a double pivot in the second leg, and I thought it worked a lot better. Now, Vancouver still lost 1-0, I think, that second leg, and just because LAFC have more talent. But I thought tactically he had figured something out. Not in this one, man. Like, whatever Steve Trillin, and like, it might have been just as simple as building a passing rhythm, and then, which is something that we hadn't seen from LAFC in a long time, but Steve Cherundolo has talked a little bit about wanting to bring that back to what his team does a little bit more. They just got so comfortable on the ball and were able to play side to side. And with Vancouver's wingbacks playing higher this year, that's something Vanny Sartini has openly talked about. Like, we want our wingbacks to be higher in the play basically all the times. I think it just ended up being too much ground to cover both vertically but also horizontally for this Whitecaps team. So a bad outing. I think talent is almost always the differentiator between these two sides, but it felt like tactically Steve Trundle hit on something here as well.
Talent has been a differentiator for Jesus Ferreira for his entire time in Major League Soccer, and he's now set a record. He is the youngest player ever to reach 50 career goals. FC Dallas with a big 2-1 win in Copa Tejas against Austin at home. Remember, this is the same stadium where Austin celebrated in the parking lot, and had they won this game, they would have been up to 9 points from, I believe, just 3 games so far this year against their Texas opposition. Dallas brought them back down to earth, and now there's still plenty to play for. This is like the first start for Jesus, I think. Musa gets a goal as well, I think, and he assists Ferreira. I don't want to take too much away from this game. I just want to know if you think that the Musa Ferreira combo is going to be able to take Dallas from, oh God, the sky is falling, to, oh God, maybe they could actually be good like we thought.
I still struggle seeing this, imagining this team being a very good MLS team, just because I think the midfield and the back line are just major problems. That said, the Ferreira-Musa combination, whether it is their first start together or not. I think those two guys make intuitive sense. And seeing Ferreira actually use his speed to get behind the defense while playing off of Musa's gravity and ability to play him through as a target forward, that is what had been a previously underutilized aspect of his game. And, you know, I like a classic forward pairing of the big guy and the little guy. So it's fun to watch, but I'm keeping my powder dry on how high I think Dallas can climb here.
Two more Copa Tejas matches in this rivalry week presented by Continental Tire. We're going to see all three cities, all three matchups. So should be pretty fun. Stay tuned on Wednesday night for more from this this rivalry triumvirate here. St. Louis 3, Chicago 1, our last game before that's WAC, which Kansas City just dominates. Double nickel derby. I-55 is the interstate that connects these two big cities. Great TIFO from the Seattle fans to start things. Love the Godzilla. Love the Midwest culture they got going there. And clearly St. Louis loves playing at home. They have struggled to win this year. It's just the third win for St. Louis. They've only lost one time, but Joe Klaus is waking up. He had a brace. He's got four goals in his last four games. That's good news for St. Louis. We're not going to spend too much time there. Let's keep it moving and get straight to that's whack. Kansas City lost at home again, Doyle. Houston 2, Kansas City 1. Vermees afterwards, quote, "There will be some suffering over there." Then he pointed to the locker room. Some real suffering. Like that is, that image is just insane and wonderful to me. And then when asked what will turn the team around, Peter said, quote, "change of mentality." And he said that repeatedly and emphatically. And then Daniel Shalloway afterwards said, quote, "if there's players who don't have the mentality, get rid of them." And then Daniel Shalloway went on to say, "if I don't have the mentality, get rid of me." Peter talked about the first goal they gave up, the Ache Ache goal off the corner kick. It is very basic. They pass it in, short corner. Ache Ache basically gets the corner of the 18, and he has no pressure coming his way and curls it in the top corner. Peter said, quote, "for us to give up that goal the way we did is amateur at best." And on the second goal, the Alu goal, that's a break from Houston, quote, "it's a lack of effort, and it's really easy to see who those people are. 2023 through 12 games, 9 points, Doyle. 2024 through 12 games, 11 points, and they're 1-3-3 at home, and all of that's whack."
Yeah. The difference being last year, around this time, they had just added essentially five new pieces. Guys like Danny Rosero, who came at the end of the transfer window last year, getting guys healthy and into the lineup and, you know, like flicking a switch, it all came together. Those guys have all been available for the most part for Sporting Kansas City. They've now played seven games at home. So more than a third of their entire home slate is in the books, and they've won only one of them. It's panic time.
Just going to let that linger a little bit there. Minnesota was panicking, or maybe not. Maybe they were used to it because Manuel Reynoso didn't return. He was gone for 7 weeks. After he failed to go to his green card appointment, he was gone for six more weeks, and then he returned without his green card. Reynoso's back, Doyle. On Sunday, he watched Minnesota United 2 play at the NSC, but he was like multiple sections over from his head coach, his owner, and a bunch of his teammates. There is a clear plan right now outlined for him to get back into the first team. Part of that plan is that he's going to kind of hit some health metrics. It's going to be like a preseason for him. He basically has to get up to speed. And then after that, if he hits those metrics, he could go train with the second team for an undefined period of time before he has a chance to rejoin the MLS side. This whole situation is whack. How do you think it ends up?
I'll still be surprised if he ever plays another minute for
Agreed.
Minnesota United. I love watching Emmanuel Reynoso play soccer. If Anders won $1 billion and bought me a club and made me the GM, even I would have trouble trading for Emmanuel Reynoso at this point. So it's a shame because he's just incredibly gifted. But
how many
not
weeks?
Worth it.
How many weeks would you last as the manager or CSO under Anders, who clearly would run
Anders
this thing
has
like
already
Jerry
answered.
Jones?
Anders has already answered that I would have 3 weeks to prove myself, and if things aren't running optimally by then, I would be forced out most likely.
"Quote: I would meddle so much." and I believe
don't read the next.
No. This. This is the rest of this is all. This is just between the three of us. All right. Before we get out of here, let's do the Liga MX minute. Big thanks to producer Maria, who always hooks us up with what's going on in Liga MX as we lead into Leagues Cup down the line. We have the semifinals in the Liguilla. It's going to be a Clásico Nacional. Club America against Chivas. That's the one seed and the sixth seed. According to Maria, Chivas is going to get smashed. I can absolutely believe that. It does not seem like Chicharito is really in form for them right now. The other semifinal is Monterrey and Cruz Azul. Cruz Azul knocked off Maria's beloved Pumas, and Monterrey dominated Tigres. And it seems like that Tigres power team era might be coming to a close here. We did mention that Pachuca lost. They lost to America. To tell you how much pressure America is under just to win at all times, Julian Quiñones scored in the 98th minute and then he cried in the post-game interview apologizing for his bad performance. That's that's both amazing and sad. I feel bad for Julian. He's been really good. And then to feel that kind of pressure when you win and move on, whoa. So we're into the semifinals and we'll see what happens from there. But the big news on an MLS perspective is that Pachuca has basically 3 weeks to sit around and wait and scout Columbus, and I'm sure they'll play some games behind closed doors as well to prepare. All right, anything left in the tank? Anything we missed somehow, some way?
I'm saving the rest of my energy for Wednesday, man. You got a long night ahead of you. You better start napping now.
I'm gonna go take a nap. Enjoy your week, everybody. We'll be back on Thursday to break it all down. Emil Forsberg will join me as well. Enjoy. Adios.